From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a Wisconsin company lets people travel across the world to volunteer while not giving up their day jobs.
I think it's a really good opportunity for companies to allow their employees to work remotely. They're still getting the productivity and potentially happier employees. And then, of course, the corporate social responsibility piece that they're able to do these pro bono projects.
Later, novelist Elizabeth Berg explains the genesis of her new title character, Arthur Truelove.
I just kept seeing this image of an older man sitting on the chair I described, and so I wrote the book to find out who he was and what he was doing there.
And we'll sit down with musician Patty Larkin as she prepares to record her next album, which will be her 14th. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. For a lot of people, traveling is a consistent life goal, whether it's about adventure during their vacations from work or perhaps working towards a retirement filled with travel. But in the case of the former, travel can be a challenge when you're limited to only 2 or 3 weeks of vacation a year.
A Milwaukee-based startup is reaching professionals who want to combine travel, work, and volunteerism. Venture with Impact is the brainchild of Wisconsin native Ann Davis and sends participants abroad to various locations around the world. Davis joins us in the studio to explain her company. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Mitch.
Before we get into the story of Venture with Impact, I'd like to hear your story. What is your background that makes it gel so well with what the work you're doing is now?
Sure. First, I think it's important to say that I am an avid traveler. I've had the opportunity to travel to over 40 countries and 5 continents. And part of what allowed me to do that was I used to be a teacher. I participated in the Teach for America program in New Orleans, and then I continued to teach in Brooklyn. And while teaching, I had the summers off, and I took advantage of all my vacations. So I traveled abroad every chance that I had.
Why was that so important for you?
I think traveling, just what I've noticed in myself and in other people as well, is it really gives you the opportunity to gain new perspectives, understand the opinions of others, understand new cultures. And I really have changed as a person, I would say. And each time that I spend abroad, I change a little bit more and I grow a bit more.
Was there a moment when you realized that that was happening to you? You know, were you someplace else and you realize that this is really more than just going someplace different? This is about transforming my life?
So actually, well, I do have a story that's a bit more personal. I did have the travel bug early on. However, in my first year of teaching, I found out that I was actually on a run with some friends. And we all of a sudden I felt a tingle in my left foot. Fell to the ground and had a grand mal seizure. Was rushed to the hospital. The emergency room doctor came in with tears in her eyes, and later, a couple weeks later, found out that I had been diagnosed with brain cancer. So that was kind of the impetus for traveling more and more. And just to say, I'm completely fine now. I've been in remission for almost 5 years.
That's terrific.
Yeah. So that kind of gave me new perspective. I knew that one of the things that I valued most was traveling because I was interested in learning about other people and other cultures, and I really enjoyed it. So that's something that I wanted to make a priority. And then after teaching for a few years and realizing after speaking with friends, family who are somewhat envious of my ability to be able to travel so much, I thought, well, yes, it's very difficult for the average American. 2 weeks of vacation, 3 weeks of vacation, that's not enough time, especially to stay in one country and really have the opportunity to soak in the culture. So I came up with the idea with a friend of mine for Venture with Impact.
So along those lines, walk us through what the objective then of Venture with Impact is. Given this background, you know, what's the objective both for the people who sign up and seek you out and for the communities and the programs to which they're traveling?
The way the program works is we set up the logistics for professionals, groups of professionals, between 5 and 15 for each month to come abroad with us in a city and stay there. We provide accommodation and workspace so that they can then work remotely for their jobs back home throughout the one-month period that they're abroad.
So they're working remotely. Do I gather they're also somehow they're participating in things that are going on in the communities where they're staying as well?
Exactly. So we also have a social impact component, which means we match each of our participants with a pro bono project that they work on with a partner organization for a few hours each week.
Well, and so, you know, you talk about the kinds of partners that you're matching them with.
Sure, yeah. So we have various partners in each of our locations, and we've had—
There are three locations at the moment, right?
Yes, yeah. So we've had programs in Peru, currently have programs in Medellin, Colombia, and then are adding programs in Thailand and Portugal next year. Many different nonprofit organizations and a few social businesses, actually, from environmental organizations, education, those that work with children, even human trafficking, and each individual, each professional has a personalized project. So, for example, we had a lawyer a couple of months ago that taught human rights workshops to the staff of a few nonprofits in Medellin. We've had educators teach workshops on curriculum development or behavior management, marketing, people with backgrounds in marketing, provide consulting on social media or marketing plans. It really varies.
So is it wrong for people to approach this thinking that this is a vacation or this is, I mean, it sounds like a working vacation on a number of levels?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. So primarily, we like to think of ourselves as what we call a workation program. And the work part comes in if you are able to work remotely. We want all people to be able to, all professionals to be able to participate. So professionals can work remotely 40 plus hours a week. And we have many, the majority of our participants work remotely. And then we also have people that are between jobs. It may be surprising to some, but people have a lot of time to explore the city, even to travel on the weekends to other parts of the country, partly because everything's set up for them. So we try to make it as easy as possible for them to find their favorite coffee shop and check out different museums in the evenings when they're not working, things like that.
So, yeah, what's the sort of support they have on the ground from you or from your company?
Yeah. So in each location, we have a program director as well as at least one local staff person helping out. And they're available 24/7. So we'll pick you up from the airport. We have a cultural orientation at the beginning. And another cool thing that we do is we do a structured weekly meetup where we talk about the projects that each person's working on. We at the beginning talk about cultural differences and communication, set goals, create metrics, and then track the progress of the projects throughout the month.
Right. I imagine you're sensitive to the idea. We should note that there's no requirement that the people who are traveling are Americans themselves. But what I'm guessing is you wouldn't want them to come to these countries and seem like the Americans trying to have a cultural experience.
Yes. Yeah. And that's another reason why we try to keep our program smaller, between 5 and 15 people, because we've noticed it gives people more of an opportunity. They really form a community among each other, but they also have more of a push and an opportunity to form relationships with the staff at their partner organization or other locals in the city.
You've been doing this for how long now?
So we launched our first program in Peru in January of 2017. So, and we've done 8 months of programming since.
Well, so talk about the kinds of experiences that people have had that you've heard about. What are you hearing from the people who have gone to these places?
Yeah, and I've been there for a little bit more than half of our programs. And the experiences range quite a bit. A couple of the really cool stories, we had a couple from Los Angeles that came, and at the end of the program, they decided that they basically fell in love with Medellin in Colombia and decided they wanted to adopt a child from the country.
Wow.
So they obviously had a very impactful experience. Yeah.
So you could be doing this program from anywhere in the world. Why do you do it here in Milwaukee?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I'm from the Waukesha area.
Okay.
I went to Kettle Moraine High School. But
I guess that counts.
Yeah. 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 And now, I mean, I'm based in Milwaukee. I stay here and I'm part of Generator's G Beta program. That's kind of why I'm back here in Milwaukee for a couple of months.
And then you will go off to these various program sites once the next round of programs begins?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
Is there any kind of requirement that people who are going places like Colombia or Thailand or Portugal speak the language?
No, there's no requirement. Of course, it's helpful. But that's one of the factors we take into account as well when matching people with their partner organization. And then we also have connections with language teachers. So if people want to take, oftentimes, especially in the Spanish-speaking countries, take lessons. I think there's going to be a demand for Portuguese as well.
You were mentioning in your background you did teach for America. And you know, I was thinking about these programs. And obviously there's a difference here because people have to pay to participate in this.
Yes.
It might not be as much as they might pay otherwise if they were doing it on an ad hoc basis. But do you see this as maybe, you know, dipping a toe into the water of service programs, whether it's Teach for America or Peace Corps or anything along those lines?
Exactly. That's definitely a big part of the idea is that, you know, again, going back to Americans only having a couple weeks of vacation a week if you're working full time, people don't have the financial means to necessarily take off of off a year or many months to be able to travel abroad and do service abroad. So
this obviously works well for people who are able to telecommute or, mm-hmm. you know, work remotely for a couple of weeks and maybe take a couple of weeks off from their jobs as part of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I gather one of the guarantees is that there will be internet service.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is the bread and butter of our company because we know that the majority of our participants are working remotely. So we make sure that all the accommodation has reliable internet and backup satellite internet and that there's co-working spaces within walking distance.
Do you have ideas? I mean, I would imagine you do. I mean, this is you're still, I guess, a startup at this point. Do you have ideas for where this goes in, you know, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years?
Sure. Yeah. So what we'd like, I mean, we will be expanding to new locations, absolutely. And then moving forward, we really like to partner with companies because it's great for them in terms of especially the millennials. I mean, all professionals want to be able to travel, but millennials are a bit more demanding, I'd say, in terms of flexibility and benefits and what they get out of their job and from their employer. So I think it's a really good opportunity for companies to allow their employees to work remotely. They're still getting the productivity and potentially happier employees. And then, of course, the corporate social responsibility piece that they're able to do these pro bono projects.
How are you reaching people?
My business partner and I have primarily used our networks, but also social media, digital marketing has been effective. And word of mouth primarily.
And I guess maybe in a nuts and bolts way, you know, obviously there's a cost to participate. But, you know, I would imagine that at some point demand is going to greatly outstrip supply in the sense that, you know, more people will be interested than there are slots in each of these programs. How do you establish who gets to go?
So we do have an application process. We have an online application, and then we do a phone interview with each applicant. And we just want to make sure. So it depends on the needs of our organizations, where we place each person. So moving forward, if having enough demand, then it will most likely be based off of the specific skills and the needs that we match. However, there are so many organizations that have various needs. So you know, it's more about the participants, not having enough participants to fill those needs or enough professionals to assist with those partner organizations.
Mm-hmm. So there is still a lot of demand.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I guess along those lines, how are you finding the organizations that want to be a part of this, you know, in these various cities?
Sure. Yeah. So we're on the ground. Initially, we develop relationships with a few different organizations based on referrals, and then referrals happen from there. So just having lots of connections in the city, we make sure we vet the organizations by meeting with their staff, visiting their project sites, and then getting a really good understanding of their needs.
So almost a full year into this, do you feel like it's gone as you'd hoped?
I think so, yeah. I mean, being an entrepreneur, and I'll even say female entrepreneur, is definitely difficult sometimes. But yeah, it's been well worth it. I think that things in reality move really quickly. But when you're in the day-to-day grind, you feel like you're not making the progress that you'd like to. But yes, I mean, considering what we've done in less than a year, I think it's been great.
The view from 30,000 feet, if you will.
Yeah.
Well, Ann Davis, it's a great story. Thank you so much, and best of luck moving forward.
Yeah, thank you.
Ann Davis founded the Wisconsin-based Venture with Impact. You'll find a link to more about the company at WUWM.com.
Elizabeth Berg delves into some pretty metaphysical territory in her new novel. We'll talk with her about the story of Arthur Truelove when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Everything will be all right. It is a simple mantra, but it's the basic belief of the main character in Elizabeth Berg's new novel, The Story of Arthur Truelove.
Arthur Moses, a.k.a. Truelove, is an 85-year-old widower. At a glance, his life seems rather ordinary. He lives with his cat, Gordon. He visits his beloved deceased wife, Nola's, grave every day at lunchtime, taking a simple sandwich and sometimes a baked good from his neighbor, Lucille. He crosses paths with another frequent graveyard visitor, the angsty 18-year-old Maddie Harris, who lost her mother at an early age.
Over time, Arthur, Maddie, and Lucille form an unconventional family of sorts, guided in large part by Arthur's quiet wisdom on the concepts of kindness, aging, acceptance, and the meaning of life itself. Berg explained to Lake Effect's Mayan Silver what drew her to write about these three characters.
The person I wanted to write about was Arthur Moses, and the other characters just kind of came along. Whenever I write a book, or most times I should say, it's a mystery, what's going to happen. It kind of creates itself as I go along. So I started with the image of an old man going out to a cemetery to sit beside his wife's grave. And that's all I knew, is that he had a little fold-up chair, that he brought his lunch, that the sandwich was wrapped in wax paper, and that he sat there every day and kind of communed with her. And then it happened that he saw the character of Maddie in the cemetery. She is a kid who's 17 years old. She's bullied in school. She has a terrible home life. She's really lonely. And they become friends. As for the third character, Lucille, she lives next door to Arthur. She's one of those people who's a real pain, but you like her anyway. She's always inviting Arthur to come and sit on the porch with her, and he's so kind-hearted that if she asks him, he always goes, but he doesn't always want to go.
So why was it important that Arthur was older and that he'd had some significant loss in his life?
Well, that's just the way he came. I just kept seeing this image of an older man sitting on the chair I described. And so I wrote the book to find out who he was and what he was doing there. And it didn't even occur to me that these three people had all lost the most significant thing in their lives until after the book was done. And that's often the way it happens.
So Arthur, his deceased wife's name is Nola. And I was hoping that you could read a passage that kind of gets a sense of his life now that he's on his own.
Sure.
This is just a passage where Arthur is at home, and it kind of describes what his daily life is.
Exactly. His life now without Nola. Arthur shuffles over to the stove and turns the heat on high under leftover beans. Then he walks back to the table and walks back to the stove. No shuffling. See, Nola? He adds ketchup to the beans, maple syrup, raw onion, Tabasco, and bacon bits from a jar, though they aren't bacon at all. He cuts a piece of cornbread, butters it, and lays it on the plate, and when the beans are warm enough, dumps them over the bread. He opens a bottle of beer and sits down to eat. Gordon jumps up on the table and stares fixedly at him. "Be my guest," Arthur says, moving the plate closer to the cat so they can share. Gordon sits with his front paws lined up exactly even and eats daintily from one side of the plate. Then he stops abruptly, shakes his head like someone sprinkled water on him, jumps off the table, and pads away, his tail held high in disdain. "You try cooking, then," Arthur says. "You think it's so easy." Funny how an animal can hurt your feelings when you're all alone. He thinks about maybe watching television later, but he can't much tolerate it anymore. What with the way people behave on there? He'll probably just take a walk around the block after dinner and hope Lucille Howard is not sitting out on her porch. If she's sitting out on her porch, he's a dead man. Lucille taught fourth grade for many years, and she seems to think the world is her classroom. She's a bit didactic for Arthur's taste, a little condescending. Odd, then, that at the thought of seeing her, his weary old heart accelerates. He supposes it could be an erratic beat. He gets them. But he'd prefer to call it something else. So much of everything is what you call it.
So that passage kind of shows the simplicity of Arthur's life and how he just sort of goes along with everything. He just sort of flows with everything. Is that kind of, how would you describe him as his attitude towards life now that he's on his own?
Not only now that he's alone, but all his life, he's a very accepting kind of person. He has lost a lot of richness in his life because he had a wonderful relationship with his wife. But he still has his routines and he still gets pleasure from the things that he does. He still loves his cat. And he's not a highly reactive person, which was such a pleasure for me to write about in these times when it seems that everyone's so violently reactive and divided.
How did he come to you as a character? Was it based on someone that you knew or a compilation or just what you aspired to?
No, he came as the image that I described earlier, and he developed himself as I went along. For me, writing is a process of discovery. So I start with the smallest thing and then just let it happen. I'm not a writer who plots or who knows in advance what's going to happen. Again, there's exceptions to that. I wrote a book about the life of George Sand, who, of course, is a real person. And in that case, there were plot elements that I used from her real life. But in this case, it was like, remember when you were a little kid, you would get things that you put in water? And
yes.
Then they would blossom.
Mm-hmm.
That's what writing books is like for me.
Interesting. So it's kind of, you know, Lucille is a different kind of character and is someone who maybe doesn't have that same inner peace that Arthur has.
Exactly.
So there's another passage where, well, she has reconnected with a man that she knew from her youth, and we won't go into details about that, but she's struggling with things at a certain point. Arthur comes in upon her at her house, their neighbors, and he discovers that she's all disheveled and her house is all unkept. And can you read a little passage about a conversation starting with Lucille talking to Arthur?
Sure. "What is left for me now? I am useless, and so are you." Arthur straightens in his chair, indignant. "I'm not useless." "You are, too. All you do is go and visit your wife at the graveyard every single day. That's all you do." "Well, first of all, I don't think it's useless to visit Nola. It is my great pleasure and honor to go to the resting place of the finest woman I ever knew and think about the boundless glory of my life with her. Okay, I'm sorry I said that. I know how you feel about Nola. I know how much it means for you to go and visit her. No, you don't. Arthur says nobody knows how much it means to me except maybe her. And apart from that, I am not useless. But what do? You don't even go to church. You take care of your roses, and that's it. Arthur rocks for a while. Lucille's chair has gone still, but Arthur rocks for a while. Let me ask you something, he says finally. What? Did you ever hear anyone say they wanted to be a writer? Yes, I've heard lots of people say that. Everybody wants to be a writer, Arthur says. Seems like. He stops his rocking to look over at her. But what we need are readers, right? Where would writers be without readers? Who are they going to write for? And actors, who are they without an audience? Actors, painters, dancers, comedians, even just ordinary people doing ordinary things. What are they without an audience of some sort? See, that's what I do. I am the audience. I am the witness. I am the great appreciator. That's what I do. And that's all I want to do. I worked for a lot of years. I did a lot of things for a lot of years. Now, well, here I am in the rocking chair, and I don't mind it, Lucille. I don't feel useless. I feel lucky.
In this passage, you can kind of see that Arthur has an attitude of positivity and of joy in the smaller things in life, right? I mean, he's an audience. And how is that an important lesson for people to have about, first of all, aging, and then secondly, life in general for anybody at any stage?
I think that in today's hectic world, we all, myself included, have a hard time slowing down to just look or just listen. And if you take a walk around your town, you usually have a mission to accomplish. You're usually going somewhere or doing something. And it's very rare that we just go out with no agenda whatsoever in order to appreciate everything that's around us. So for me, it's a revelation sometimes to just slow down and listen to the chickens who live around the corner from me. And to look at the way that nature changes every single day, there's something different. And I think one of the positive things about growing older is that gradually we start to have more of a sense of that. Maybe our lives aren't quite so hectic anymore, especially if we've retired from jobs that we used to have. So this allows us to have that kind of expansion and to see and take in things that may be called simple or ordinary, but really are kind of extraordinary.
There's, you know, the book is kind of full of these lessons from Arthur and then from the way he interacts with people. And Maddie is a character who we haven't talked about too much. She brings a little bit of a different stage of life into the book about youth, and she's a late teen, and, you know, she's going through her own things. But there's a moment where they're all in the house that they... I don't want to give up too much plot, but they're all in a house together, Maddie, Lucille, and Arthur, and they're watching Pennies from Heaven.
Mm-hmm. Maddie has a great appreciation for the things she observes and learns about Arthur in particular, but also in just living with older people. And one of the things they like to do is watch old movies together. And this is a passage about them watching a movie. The other night, they ate the popcorn balls Lucille had made and watched Pennies from Heaven. Maddie, curled under a pink crocheted afghan, was struck by the lyrics of the song, the idea of happiness being payment for having endured adversity. Maddie's life lately has been an onslaught of outsized good fortune. deep inside is a voice wanting to taunt her, to tell her she is undeserving of it, to not trust it, because it won't last. Good things never last. Or it tells her she will mess up and lose everything. But she's gotten better at tuning that voice out. I think it's, you know, life is uneven. Everyone experiences that. The pendulum always does swing. It's never going to be goodness all the time, but it's never going to be bad things all the time either. And I think the onus is on us to sort of build up our internal resources so that we can weather the storms that will inevitably come along. It's a lot easier to weather those storms if you have love in your life, if you think well of yourself. If you don't have those things, it's really a hard row. So what Lucille and Arthur give Maddie is a better sense of self, a sense of worth, a sense that she's loved, and to have something to fall back on when things don't go so well, to understand that life is a balance and that you can ride the waves, that there's a lot of resilience inside each person to do that.
In your acknowledgments at the end of the book, you write, "Last but most, thank you to all the people who read my books and make it possible for me to make a living doing what I love. It still feels like a miracle. May it always." That seems like a pretty Arthur True Love commentary.
Well, it's how I really feel. I was talking about this the other night at a reading. It does still feel like a miracle that I can make my living doing the thing I love most. I always loved writing, but I never tried to get published until later in life. I was actually a registered nurse for 10 years before I became a writer full-time. And I wanted to be a writer because I loved it, but I also wanted to be a writer because I wanted to stay home with my daughters. And writing allowed me to do that at the time they were 4 and 9. So there isn't a day, honestly, that goes by that I don't feel grateful for the fact that I can do what I do. What a joy for someone who has a very active imagination to know that she can use it in a way that helps her put chicken on the table.
Elizabeth Berg, thank you so much for coming and speaking about the book.
I'm really glad you asked me to. Thank you.
Chicago writer Elizabeth Berg's latest novel is called The Story of Arthur Truelove. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mayon Silver. Berg will talk about the book this evening at Milwaukee's Boswell Book Company.
One more break and then a conversation with Milwaukee native, the singer-songwriter Patty Larkin. That's when Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Well, the man in the hallway is cleaning up grief, while travelers chase after time like a thief. With oversized bags, they wait for relief in the dark.
If a city can have a favorite son, there is no reason it can't have a favorite daughter as well. And in the music world, you could very easily nominate Patty Larkin as Milwaukee's favorite daughter. Larkin grew up here before moving on to make a name for herself for her proficiency as a musician and a songwriter.
Larkin recorded her first album in 1985, and 12 more followed. She's also played as part of the Four Bitchin' Babes and has championed the cause of fellow women guitarists. Larkin has long lived in Massachusetts, but returns to her hometown every so often, including this fall when she visited family and played a show to benefit the Urban Ecology Center. We invited her to join us in the studio as well, and she shared a couple of songs, including this one inspired by Bob Dylan called The Best of Intentions.
Thinking you figured it wrong. Well, the sun went away and it ain't coming back. Would be a shame if you forgot how to laugh. would be a shame turning your back on a song. The best of intentions all get up and leave before long. I told you I loved you, I tried not to cry. I told you the angels all know how to fly. Cross my heart, this ain't goodbye to so long. Red sky at night is a sailor's delight. So I put on my skates and I'm crossing the ice. Holding my breath, I think once or twice about God. But the best of intentions all get up and leave before long. Well, the man in the hallway is cleaning up grief. The faithful will always fall back on belief. I wish there was something I could believe to belong. But the best of intentions all get up and leave before long. Yeah, best of intentions all get up and leave before long.
Patty Larkin in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Inspired by old what's-his-name, Robert Zimmerman.
Exactamente.
And kind of a Buckets of Rain feel to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the fabulous thing about, I talk about this with my songwriting students that, you know, last summer they were from 17 to 70 in the same workshop. But that, you know, the longer you keep doing this, you hear the same material, you hear the same song, and it's deeper. It's weightier. You understand more on many different levels sometimes. I was listening to a John Hurt song on our public radio station, on our community radio station in Provincetown, Mass. And it was something that I had played in college, you know, and I thought, God, I really had it down, you know. And I listened to it on the radio. I was like, oh, my God, I completely missed the dance jiggy beat in there, you know, that it was – I was such a white kid when I was playing it. I just thought I had it, you know. Like, I got John Hurt, you know, and I'm like, how did I miss that? It's just kind of astounding sometimes.
How about your own back catalog? I mean, you've been recording for more than three decades.
That's
now.
Right.
Do you feel like you get more out of your own stuff when you look back at it today? Were there things going on in it that you might not even have been aware of when you were recording it?
I think sometimes I listen to the production and I get impressed or depressed, I suppose. But what I've been doing too is, like, if I take a request at a show, I have to go backstage and go to lyric.com in order to request. Luckily, they have Wi-Fi most places now. But I've been kind of cycling some of the older songs back into the sets and of course playing requests when I can remember them.
Are you ever surprised when people request something?
Yeah, there's certain songs people never request, and so when they do every 10 years, you're just kind of amazed, and you just have to apologize. No, I have to relearn that one. But it's interesting. I mean, there are certain ones that people really like. They like Metal Drums, which is about Woburn, Mass, and W.R. Grace's contamination of that site. And, you know, so there's certain songs I think that resonate with people. But I do get people coming up just saying, you know, you really helped me through a hard time. And I appreciate that because it's words that you must listen to sometimes. I'm doing, you know, sets of material some people have never heard before, and to know that someone has been listening means a lot.
Well, and it really has to be amazing at some level to give voice to feelings that people you've never even met are having.
Right. Yeah, and you know, and we can have that moment, and I can be really full of myself, especially after a show. Like, you can pretty much ask me to do a benefit for gerbils, and I'll say yes. That's how much fun I'm having. But yeah, when somebody stops me and just says, I just need to tell you something, you know.
How long does it take for you to read the mood of an audience when you start a show?
You know what? I just did a show in Somerville, Mass, down the street from where I used to live in an unheated third floor apartment. So it was meaningful to me.
I used to visit my uncle in a third floor Somerville, Massachusetts unheated apartment.
There you go.
Yes.
You know exactly of where I speak. But you know, and some shows you go in and you can feel the energy from the backstage area. You know, where it's just they're already in fourth gear. You just pray that you don't go out there and fall off the stage, which can happen. But and then some shows, especially if it's in a new place or somewhere I haven't played much, or they're just quiet. And the thing that you I have to remember is that the audiences are different from one night to another, and I just have to not – the things I might go for, especially in the patter, you know, are not going to work here because I'm not getting the response, and so then I'm second-guessing it, and so then I'm thinking, which is, like, deadly. So then I have to listen just to what I'm singing and saying. And, you know, then when they stand up at the end and go, yay, you go, oh, my God, you heard this. But that can be it can just depend. You know, it just really you have to kind of believe in the sounds that you're making, I think, at some point.
And when you started doing this, you weren't playing to the tops of people's heads, you know, who might be looking down at a glowing screen.
Yeah, you know, what I find if I'm at a concert not all that often, but I mean, it's like, you know, there I am. I was going to sit in with Tom Rush, and you know, I'm in the back listening to his set, and I'm looking at screens taping him, and that changes the mood and the lighting for me. It's distracting.
Do you feel like does the audience shape a show for you, or do you find it is it your responsibility or your goal to kind of shape how they're feeling by the end of
them.
The night? Yeah, well, right. Or lead them in a nicer
you're
way.
You learn something here.
Yeah.
The D chord. I think, you know, both. I mean, I go in and now I'm kind of aiming, trying to not tailor the shows, but I have a focus, you know, like. Certain points this year, my only focus was to spread joy, you know? For me.
I wondered about that.
Yeah.
You know, our audience is craving joy when they come to one of your
shows.
Yeah,
there was some physical pain there a year ago. I told the audience last Friday, for a minute, my new record was going to be called I Hate Everybody But You, you know, and I'm better now. I feel better. Things are okay. But I think you have to listen a little bit, and if they're sometimes they'll just yell something out and you know, oh, okay, we're going to go there to that quadrant of, you know, or you ask for a request. That's a good way to kind of check in. A lot of times I'll use humor within the song to see if I'm kind of fishing to see if they kind of chuckle. And if they do, I know, okay, if three people do, then I know they're listening and that they kind of get that, you know, irony or whatever I'm fishing for.
Well, in terms of these being fraught times, what about when you are an audience member, either at someone else's show mm-hmm. or you're reading a book? Are you looking for joy these days? Do you look to art for inspiration or escapism, or you know, where do you come down on the influence of art in your own life today?
You know, I don't know why the touchstone for me is when my uncle, who was a Catholic priest, I had two uncles Catholic priests, but Uncle Jack, he. He was in hospice, and his friend, also a priest, came in, and he just prayed. I don't even know if we did. We may have done a little mass, but I think it was mainly prayers that I knew as a kid. And that touchstone for me was so important. And I've been working, you know, teaching the same week as poets in the summers, and I feel like they, for some reason, really speak to me. There's just an unbridled passion that they have. Sometimes it doesn't have the ABABC form of the song, and maybe that speaks to me. But I think that you almost, when you're feeling just kind of broken, you're looking for that. You're looking for the word that will help you through it. And so when I go to a concert, the thing I find, or a live performance, the thing I find is that there'll be something that performer says or does throughout in the evening that resonates with me, and it might even be something I don't even know I'm thinking about. And that, to me, is the magic of it, that you can connect with something within yourself that you have been puzzled about or grieving, and it will lift you up in a different way. It's a different part of the brain that is cycling around there. The mouse is switched to the other side, and running very quickly.
You have a couple of teenagers at home. Do you
yes.
have to? Do you have to model that approach to them?
Modeling and staying calm. Stay calm. Eat ketchup. That's our motto.
I was going to ask if it helps to be near the ocean at a time like that.
I think it does. I mean, for me, I mean, the lake here does the same thing for me. I mean, it's very similar. You have this big, huge expanse that is a wilderness, you know, within itself. And even though, you know, motorboats, jet skis are zipping across it. But I think having that, they say, and Native Americans believe that the 360-degree view is a sacred view, and I think you have that here. And just getting in touch with something larger than yourself, it reminds you that puts into perspective, I think.
Did I hear you mention just a few minutes ago that there is a new record that might be on the way?
Yes. Yeah. It's taking me 4 years or so. It's a concept album, and it took me 4 years to figure out the concept, apparently.
It's not gerbils, right?
Yeah, right. But if it's for gerbils. It started as basically an instrumental record and then morphed. I just started writing songs to some of the instrumentals, you know, that kind of just is the way I am because I'm a songwriter. And then also turns out that instrumentals are kind of hard. you have to learn them before you record them. And then I started meeting poets and people like Marie Howe, Nick Flynn, Natalie Diaz, that teach at this Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown. And my last album had a poem by Kay Ryan that I set to music, and I bumped into somebody, and he was, long story short, I ended up kind of opening up poetry every morning when I would start to write. I would read a poem, and then I was like, well, let's see what the Stanley Kunitz thing would do, you know? And so I have 10 poems that I've set to music and 10 songs for them, and then I wrote some songs that are sort of responses to that, and not completely 10, but I have the instrumentals as well. So it's going to be a combination of all those things. I'm going to start recording in a full-fledged studio with a Hammond B3 next month.
Oh, outstanding. Well, we can't wait.
I know. Me too.
Let me just say, Patty Larkin, thank you so much. And I hope you'll play one more song for us, whether or not it's from the new one.
I'll do my Who Holds Your Hand. People like that one a lot.
Milwaukee native Patty Larkin recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio while she was in town earlier this fall to play a show benefiting the Urban Ecology Center.
Larkin lives on Cape Cod, but you do have another opportunity to catch her on stage not too far away. She'll play a show at the Woodstock Opera House just across the border in Woodstock, Illinois, on December 23rd.
My mother, my father, I'm holed up in the bell tower, looking for four walls to bounce off, looking for a donkey I can maybe pin a tail on, yeah. Yeah. Well, I've taken to staying up late, taking up bowling, take a couple aspirin, and I call my lover in the morning, and I've taken to talking to myself. I don't even get it. Gotta get out of my head. It'll drive me crazy if I let it. Who holds your hand when you're alone? Who holds your hand when you're
Patty Larkin's set in the Lake Effect Performance Studio was engineered by the incomparable Jason Reavy.
And of course, Jason is one of the many people who makes this show possible every week. Our staff also includes producers Audrey Nowakowski, Joy Powers, and Mayon Silver, plus reporters Rachel Morello, Susan Benz, and Aisha Turner.
We get web support from Michelle Maternowski, and this week we say goodbye and good luck to our terrific intern, Meredith Waters, who wraps up the semester at Marquette University and who will go on to great things. We appreciate all her good work for us this fall. And that's the Friday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Do be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next.
Well, now some people believe in Jesus. Guess that works real good. Some people believe in God like they believe in knocking on wood. Religion is a picture window. Life is not a pretty picture. It rattles when the wind blows. Never knew it hit her. Who holds your hand when you're alone? Who holds your hand when you're alone? Who holds your hand when you're alone? Who holds your hand when you're when you're alone, who holds your hand when you're alone?